You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 129, I Am Charlemagne. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. You are only a small fraction of the audience, but without your help, I wouldn't be able to do this. Thank you. And, as always, I'd like to invite the rest of you to join us on Patreon. Those of you who are not listening to the bonus episodes are really missing out. We cover a huge range of topics, from things that are a bit quirky or off the beaten path, to more details on the big, significant events we cover here in the main narrative. You'll also get a chance to get to know some of the memoirists I quote from in the main narrative, many of whom are great characters in their own right, on top of being interesting as eyewitnesses to these amazing events. You can get access to all 38 bonus episodes, plus ad-free versions of the regular episodes, for just $2 a month. Give it a try for just 1 month, and I have a feeling you will enjoy all the bonus material and the feeling of satisfaction from supporting the show a lot more than you miss the $2. Visit patreon.com/ageofnapoleon to sign up. Anyway, we left off last time in the spring of 1809. We are still a bit further back in the past than the last time we left Napoleon in the main narrative, because we are still getting caught up on the war in Iberia. The last major event we covered in this theater was the liberation of Porto on May 12, 1809. About 2 months before, Napoleon defeated Archduke Charles at the Battle of Wagram and the Battle of Znaim, leading to a ceasefire between France and Austria. We'll start this episode by continuing where we left off last time. The victory of the Anglo-Portuguese army at Porto had secured Portugal for the coalition, at least for the moment. The main Allied commander in this theater, General Sir Arthur Wellesley, had about 25,000 British and German regulars under his command. They were bolstered by local Portuguese forces, the remains of the old Portuguese army, plus a motley collection of volunteer regiments, militias, and guerrillas. The Portuguese were building a new military, with the assistance of British officers, but that would be a long, painstaking process that had only just begun. Back in London, the British leadership hemmed and hawed over their next course of action in this theater. The obvious next step would be to take the fight to Spain, but the failure of Sir John Moore's expedition the previous year was still fresh in everyone's mind. Many were wary of Spain's rough terrain, wide-open spaces, and poor infrastructure. Portugal would be a thorn in Napoleon's side as long as it remained free from occupation. There was an argument to be made that Wellesley should stay put, stick close to his base of operations at Lisbon, and hold on to this important foothold, at least until more troops could be brought in. The government actually changed their orders to Wellesley several times before finally giving him the go-ahead to take his small army across the border. Even then, they made it clear he would be doing so at his own discretion, meaning Wellesley alone would take the blame if the army came to disaster. The British marched to the town of Abrantes, not far from the Spanish border, but were forced to stop when they ran out of cash. Britain and Portugal were allies, and the goodwill of the Portuguese people had already been of great use during this campaign. If they aimed to keep things that way, and maintain this dynamic as they entered Spain, the army would need to pay for all, or at least most, of its food and supplies, rather than relying on theft and foraging like the French. Wellesley also needed to keep his men paid if he hoped to maintain their discipline. There had already been incidents of looting and abuses against civilians by British soldiers on the march to Abrantes. Wellesley sent a memorandum to his officers, telling them to keep their men under close watch. but he knew this task would be impossible unless the soldiers had a little money in their pockets and enough food and drink to satisfy their appetites. The only way to get enough gold and silver for an invasion of Spain was to bring it all the way from Britain, and so Wellesley and his army waited. Coincidentally, there was a similar situation playing out in the main theater of the war on the Danube, where Napoleon was marshaling his forces for another crossing of the river after his defeat at Aspern-Essling. Wellesley finally got his money at the end of June, and his army crossed the Spanish border on July 3rd, 2 days before the fighting began at Wagram. Their target would be a French corps under Marshal Claude Victor. We last saw Victor crushing a small Spanish army at the Battle of Uccles. By now, he had advanced to the town of Mérida. Victor's corps was depleted, with well under 20,000 men. It was also exposed, close to the Portuguese border and quite far from any other significant French units, and from their base of operations at Madrid. An excellent target for the coalition. Wellesley planned to rendezvous with a larger Spanish army under General Gregorio de la Cuesta, which would bring the total Allied strength to over 50,000 men. Then they would march on Mérida and use their superior numbers to get between Victor and Madrid. Meanwhile, near Madrid, General Francisco Javier Venegas, who had been defeated by Victor at Uccles, would go back on the offensive to tie down the French forces in and around the capital and prevent them from reinforcing Victor. It was a solid plan, but almost as soon as it was set, things began to go wrong. Generals Wellesley and Cuesta would be collaborating closely over the coming weeks and months, and they instantly disliked each other. Wellesley saw Cuesta as a doddering old fool, and it seems Cuesta picked up on this because he saw Wellesley as arrogant and disrespectful, and suspected his British counterpart was trying to sideline him and subordinate the Spanish contingent to the British, which was actually true. Almost as soon as the two generals met, Wellesley began badmouthing Cuesta to the junta, clearly angling to get him replaced. Allied success in this phase of the fighting might depend on Cuesta and Wellesley's working relationship. We've seen in past episodes how divided command could lead to disaster on the battlefield. This was not a good sign for the coming campaign. Then the British supply system began to break down. Wellesley had to threaten to pull out of the campaign entirely and go back to Portugal just to get his Spanish allies to help. Meanwhile, they had missed their chance to attack Victor at Mérida. The marshal had learned of Wellesley's advance, and he could read a map as well as anyone. It immediately became clear that his position was very exposed, and he ordered his corps to retreat to the city of Talavera along the Tagus River, a much more defensible position, much closer to Madrid and the other French forces in Spain. The Allied campaign was not off to an auspicious start. But Wellesley and Cuesta would continue to pursue a battle against Victor. On July 23rd, the British and Spanish forces converged outside Talavera and approached the city. This would be a pretty small affair compared to what was going on in Central Europe, but Wellesley and Cuesta had well over 50,000 men. As we've discussed in the past, armies in this theater tended to be smaller. So, by Iberian standards, this was a very large force. The city of Talavera itself was only held by a small number of French infantry. The main imperial position was in the outskirts. However, there was a sharp skirmish as the Allies forced their way into the city. The French delayed the enemy as long as they could, then set fire to the city and nearby farms, and retreated with all the loot they could carry. In retaliation, the Spanish massacred their French prisoners. Some in the British contingent had only recently arrived in Iberia. I'm sure at least a few of them were wondering what kind of conflict they had just stepped into. With the city itself under Allied control, Wellesley and Cuesta met to plan their next move. Wellesley argued for an immediate attack. The French position was strong, but they were outnumbered by perhaps as much as 4-1. There was a chance to inflict some real damage here. His Spanish counterpart agreed, and the preparations were made. Within only a few hours, Wellesley himself was personally leading forward two British infantry divisions. However, the Spanish made no move to join them. Perhaps there genuinely was a miscommunication here. Few officers in either contingent spoke their allies' language, and the two armies had only been united for a few weeks. They were still learning to work together. But given the friction between the two commanders and Cuesta's cantankerous personality, this might have been pure pettiness. The British halted their advance until this issue could be settled, but it never was. The French and Allied forces spent the rest of the day glaring at each other, then Victor fell back towards Madrid after nightfall. Now it was Wellesley's turn to be obstinate. Cuesta and the Spanish took off in pursuit of Victor first thing in the morning, but the British stayed put at Talavera. To the west, General Venegas had failed to pin the French down around Madrid. Tens of thousands of imperial troops were already marching to reinforce Victor, led by the alleged King of Spain himself, Joseph Bonaparte. At least in theory, but Joseph's military expertise was practically non-existent, so in practice his troops were led by his chief military advisor, General Jean-Baptiste Jourdan. We haven't mentioned Jourdan since all the way back in episode 49. To refresh your memories, during the latter years of the Revolution, he had led significant Republican armies in the field. He had never been one of Napoleon's favorites, so we haven't had much cause to talk about him lately, but he was very experienced and quite capable. After his fall from power, Napoleon would admit he had underrated Jourdan. Marshal Jean de Dieu Soult was on his way as well, coming from Galicia to the northwest, where he had retreated with the remains of his corps after the failed invasion of Portugal. But, as they often did, the French underestimated the difficulty of rapid movement over Iberia's rough terrain and bad roads. Soult and his men had a long way to go over some very difficult ground. Still, the French soon had over 45,000 men concentrated west of Madrid, and were being pursued by Cuesta's army of only about 30,000, many of whom were inexperienced, poorly led volunteers and militia. This could easily have led to yet another disaster for the Spanish, but once again the Patriots' advantage in intelligence paid off. Cuesta was informed of the situation with plenty of time to pull his troops back towards Talavera, where his ally Wellesley was already preparing for a defensive battle. Napoleon followed these events closely through letters and official reports. He seemed optimistic about French prospects, writing to his brother Joseph, quote, "It will be an excellent opportunity for giving the English a lesson and finishing the war," end quote. The French approached Talavera on July 26th, and it seems the Allied scouts were not doing their jobs, because King Joseph's advance units were able to launch a preliminary attack on the outlying Allied positions without being detected. Completely surprised, an entire British brigade was shattered and fell back in disorder. Wellesley himself was at the front lines, surveying the ground, and was nearly captured. He and his staff had to mount up and ride away at full gallop. How different the subsequent history of the war in Iberia might have been if they'd lingered a little longer. Fortunately for the coalition, the rest of the French army had not yet arrived, so they were not able to follow up on this success. The furthest forward British and Spanish units fell back towards their main position to await the enemy attack. The Allied army was arranged facing roughly east. The British contingent was on the left, with their flank anchored on an area of high, rocky ground. The Spanish took the right, with their flank anchored on the city of Talavera and the Tagus River. Wellesley had chosen his ground well. The Allied position was very strong. They held most of the high ground on the battlefield, and were protected in the front by woods, streams, and gullies, and anchored on both flanks by strong natural barriers. The only drawback was that the combined Allied forces were slightly too small to hold this position comfortably. Wellesley and Cuesta had to put almost all their troops in the front line, with only a few thousand men in reserve. If the French could punch through, there would not be much stopping them from compromising the entire position, and probably winning a lopsided victory. But only if they could make a dent in this imposing line. The British were slow to get into position. For many of them, this was their first time deploying for a large set-piece battle, and inevitably there were mistakes and miscues. When the action started, several British units were still not in position. The Battle of Talavera began on July 27, 1809. With a small French probing attack on the Allied center right. They had correctly judged that this was a weak point in that commanding enemy position, an area with relatively few natural defenses, held by inexperienced Spanish volunteers. As we've seen in past episodes, these poorly trained, poorly led Patriot militia units were rarely able to hold up under sustained pressure from French veterans. After a brief exchange of fire, they broke and ran for the comparative safety of the buildings of Talavera, just behind the Spanish right. The sight of these fleeing Spanish troops set off a panic in the Allied rear. Many of the camp followers, civilian contractors, and support units behind the army joined the rout, believing the whole Allied line was compromised and the battle lost. Fortunately for the Allies, the panic did not spread to other combat units. However, there was now a huge gaping hole right in the middle of that brittle defensive line. It was a golden opportunity for the French. But they did not follow up on their success. Much of their army was still not deployed for battle, so perhaps they simply didn't have the means to press their advantage. This attack had taken place in a wooded area, and it's also possible they were actually unable to see how much damage they had done to the enemy. Whatever the case, Cuesta was able to shuffle his units around and rebuild the line before the Allies were in any danger. Meanwhile, on the north of the battlefield, Marshal Victor was studying the enemy position through his spyglass and saw an opportunity. The left flank of the Allied force, held by the British, was supposed to run along a ridge line on a hill known as the Cerro de Medellin. But, as we already discussed, the British were slow in making their deployments. By this point, the hill was still not occupied. Victor already had his advance units formed up and ready to move, so he ordered them forward immediately to seize that hill. There were only a few battalions available to make the attack. Sending them forward alone, unsupported by artillery or cavalry, before the rest of the army was even deployed, right into the heart of the enemy position, was a big risk. But the potential payoff was even bigger. If the French could ensconce themselves on the Cerro de Medellin and bring up artillery, the whole Allied position would be compromised, and Wellesley and Cuesta would almost certainly have no choice but to retreat. The battle could be won in a single stroke before it really began. The French formed their assault columns and marched forward on the double. The British rushed to take their positions on the hill. The Redcoats won the race, but just barely. They had just finished forming up when the French attack slammed home. There was a short, bitter fight, but the disorganized British could not hold, and soon were running downhill. The British commander in this area, General Sir Rowland Hill, was well aware of the importance of this position. He formed up one of his best units, the Royal Irish Fusiliers, for an immediate counterattack. and led them up the Cerro de Medellin himself. There was hard fighting, but the French held them off, and soon the Irishmen too were running downhill. But General Hill was not about to give up. By now, the fighting on the Cerro de Medellin had been going on for over an hour, but the French still had not been able to bring up reinforcements. They had brought up artillery, and from this commanding position, the French gunners were able to target almost the entire Allied position. The British and Spanish suffered terribly under this bombardment. But with only 3 French infantry battalions holding the hill, the opportunity to push them back was still there. The British had to seize that opportunity immediately, or the battle was almost certainly already lost. They launched another counterattack, this time spearheaded by the 29th Regiment of Foot, who Wellesley would later call the best regiment in his army. There was a long and bloody struggle, but finally the French were forced to retreat. Victor's gamble had failed, and the Allied position was saved, at least for the moment. Still, it had been very close. Wellesley and Cuesta had been perhaps only minutes away from complete disaster. And the cost had been tremendous. During the fighting on the Cerro de Medellin, the British lost about 800 men. The Battle of Talavera had barely begun, and already it was the bloodiest engagement the British had fought in Iberia so far. The French had only suffered a few hundred casualties. By now, darkness was fast approaching. The final British counterattack on the Cerro de Medellin would be the last significant action of the day. As was almost always the case in these multi-day battles, it was an uneasy night. Intermittent musket fire never totally died down, and every man on both sides was keenly aware of the closeness of the enemy. Even Sir Arthur Wellesley, who was notorious for his ability to sleep almost anywhere under any circumstances, was apparently awake most of the night. The French artillery opened up just after dawn on July 28th, battering the whole Allied line, but focusing mostly on the British, and in particular the heights of the Cerro de Medellin, which had seen such heavy fighting the previous day. They were not trying to hide their intentions. That hill was clearly one of the key positions on the battlefield, and they aimed to take it. This time, Marshal Victor would send forward an entire division, nearly 10 times the size of the force that had attacked the previous day, and with proper artillery support. But this time, the British were ready for them. The redcoats poured musket fire onto the French columns as they climbed the hill. But these were veteran troops, and they just kept coming despite heavy casualties. Many armies the French had faced in the past could not stand up to this type of pressure. Time and again, we've seen Spanish units break apart under these circumstances. Sources differ as to what happened as the French approached the crest of the hill. Some claim several British units did indeed begin to fall back. Others claim the whole line held firm. In any case, Victor's columns got within a few yards of their objective, but no further. Under sustained musket fire, they were unable to press the attack home. There was a brief but intense firefight around the summit of the hill before the French fell back towards their own lines. Once again, it had been a hard struggle. The French suffered over 1,000 casualties, and the British over 700. But once again, Victor had failed to take the Cerro de Medellin, and the Allied position remained secure. Around this time, 2 messages reached French headquarters that would dictate the subsequent course of the battle. One came from the east. The French garrison at Toledo reported they were under attack by General Venegas' army. You might recall that Venegas had been sent to pin down the French forces in central Spain. He had failed at this mission, but had kept up the offensive. Now his troops were outside the French-held city of Toledo, and the garrison was in serious jeopardy. Joseph and Jourdan had taken almost every available soldier in central Spain to come fight here at Talavera, leaving behind only the bare minimum to garrison the rear. That meant that if Venegas could capture Toledo, he would soon realize there was not much stopping him from advancing on Madrid. The other message came from the northwest. It was from Marshal Soult, informing them that his march had been delayed, and he was nowhere close to Talavera. They had hoped Soult would be arriving imminently. In fact, it would be almost 2 weeks before he was even in the area, and that was assuming he wasn't delayed even further. These two pieces of news completely changed the strategic thinking at French headquarters. They could not afford to let Venegas to even threaten Madrid, let alone take it. With Soult unable to offer any assistance, that meant they would have to detach a large portion of their force to counter this threat as soon as possible. That meant they had to win a decisive victory at Talavera immediately. The French leadership conferred and decided their only option was to put all their efforts into one big push, aiming to win the battle in a single stroke. The French had come tantalizingly close to capturing the Cerro de Medellin twice, but would not be tempted to attack it a third time. Instead, they would focus on the mostly untouched center of the Allied position, where the terrain was relatively flat. The main thrust of the assault would hit just to the right of the seam where the British and Spanish sections of the line met, then be joined by a secondary assault on the center left, hopefully driving a wedge between the two contingents of the enemy army, and punching through into the Allied rear. At around noon, every French cannon on the battlefield opened up to prepare for the attack. The bombardment was so intense, Allied officers ordered their men to lie down to present smaller targets to the enemy. It helped, but both the British and Spanish contingents suffered terrible losses. The main effort would be against the British. They had borne the brunt of the fighting so far and were presumably weakened. The epicenter of the attack would pit the best units on both sides against each other. This section of the British line was held by the Guards Division, including men from such vaunted regiments as the Coldstream Guards and the Scots Guards. And the French attack in this sector would be spearheaded by General Horas Sebastiani's division, composed entirely of long-serving French veterans, many of whom had been with Napoleon in his great campaigns of 1805, 6, and 7. The French attack was poorly coordinated. Sebastiani and his men were supposed to open this phase of the fighting, but the smaller secondary attack under General Jean-François Laval went off first. Apparently, Laval had gotten confused in the wooded terrain and thought he was actually late, so had rushed his men forward too early. Laval's troops were mostly German, facing an entrenched Spanish position. The Germans charged. The Spanish held them off, but Laval reformed his troops and charged again, this time overcoming the Spanish position. When the main Allied attack finally launched, the first units into the fray almost immediately met disaster. Advancing through olive groves, they were unable to see the British line until they were almost on top of it. Suddenly emerging from the trees with the British right in front of them, they found they had to climb down an embankment at the edge of the olive grove, which broke up their formations. Then they were hit with a devastating volley. Seeing their enemies disorganized and wavering, the British charged. The French were beaten back with heavy casualties, losing several cannon. Further to the north, the British Guards Division did much the same thing, greeting the French with a volley, then rushing them with the bayonet. The French fell back, and the Guards surged forward. It seemed the French assault was over almost as soon as it began. Then General Sebastiani launched a second wave. Rushing forward in pursuit of what they believed was a defeated enemy, the Guards were in no position to receive an enemy charge. They had no choice but to turn tail and run, Many were cut down as they fled. This could have spelled disaster for the Allies. The part of the line formerly occupied by the Guards was almost wide open. Nearby units extended their lines to compensate, but there was still a significant gap, held only by a perilously thin screen of light cavalry. As I mentioned at the beginning of this battle, if the French could punch through this brittle line, they would almost certainly win the day. With his forces already stretched near the breaking point, Wellesley could only afford to detach a single battalion from his left flank to stem the tide in the center, men from the 48th Regiment of Foot, recruited from England's East Midlands. The French surged forward, but were slowed by the wooded terrain, and then were engaged by the remains of the British center and that battalion of the 48th. An intense firefight broke out. It must have been incredibly frustrating for the French. They could see that gap directly in front of them, which they knew represented victory. But with the British pouring on musket fire along both flanks, they had no choice but to advance very slowly so they could return fire. Apparently, at one point, the British and French troops were only separated by about 30 yards, or 27 meters. Even with crude early 19th century muskets, it was hard to miss from that range. Meanwhile, behind the lines, the officers of the Guards Division were working desperately to rally and reorganize their shattered battalions. Fortunately for the Allies, the ongoing firefight bought them the time they needed. Soon, that tantalizing gap in the British lines was plugged by the remains of the Guards Division. The attack had failed, and the French began to fall back. The fighting had been furious. In this assault alone, the French suffered over 4,000 casualties, and the British 2,500. Every unit on both sides engaged in this fight in the center suffered at least 25% casualties, some closer to 50. The most deadly phase of the fighting, that firefight around the position vacated by the Guards Division, had only lasted a few minutes. This intensity of firepower is rarely seen in Napoleonic combat. It was almost more like something out of 20th century warfare. The 48th Regiment of Foot, who had borne the brunt of the fighting, would be known as the Heroes of Talavera for the rest of the regiment's history. But the French were not beaten yet. That hill on the British left flank, the Cerro de Medellin, still called out to Marshal Victor. Taking this position would almost certainly mean winning the day, and Victor's troops had come very close twice. He didn't order a full-on assault, but ordered a relatively small number of infantry to the base of the hill to probe the position. He knew Wellesley had taken some of his troops off the hill to reinforce the center, so maybe the position was now weak enough to be taken. In response to this threat, Wellesley called on his light cavalry. They trotted forward, drew their sabers, and set out to charge the French columns. This was a blunder. The ground between the British cavalry and the enemy was broken and difficult to navigate. The horsemen found it difficult to move quickly and build up their momentum. The veteran French troops had more than enough time to form squares and began blasting away at the horsemen as they approached. Some of the British troopers rode past the French squares, but almost all were killed or captured very quickly. Those with better sense reined in their horses and rode back to their own lines. The charge never seriously threatened the French. One unit, the 23rd Light Dragoons, suffered so many casualties they would be sent back to England after the battle. It was still early afternoon, and this was Europe at the height of summer. It would be hours before dusk. The French had suffered heavy casualties, but they still had fresh units in reserve. The battle could have continued, but it seems the French leadership decided further attacks would be pointless. Napoleon would criticize them harshly for this decision. he never gave up so easily. But the Allied position was incredibly formidable. French forces were depleted. And even if they somehow won the battle with another bloody attack, they would still have to worry about General Venegas in their rear. The Battle of Talavera was over. The French lost just over 7,000 men killed, wounded, or captured. Allied casualty numbers are a bit sketchier, but about the same. It had very nearly gone the other way, but after over a decade of war, the British had finally won their first major victory over a French army of roughly equivalent size. Of course, it was a Spanish victory as well. Today, Talavera is mostly remembered as a British battle, won by Wellesley. As you just heard, the Redcoats had borne the brunt of the fighting, but it is worth mentioning that victory could not have been achieved without the participation of the Spanish. The cost had been considerable. As you might imagine, the British suffered the vast majority of Allied casualties. As I said, numbers are sketchy, but Wellesley had lost perhaps over 6,000 men, representing somewhere between a fifth and a quarter of his entire field army. From a strategic perspective, the loss of so many men was actually not a serious setback. There were already thousands of reinforcements landed at Lisbon, just organizing themselves and waiting for the rest of their supplies and equipment to arrive, before marching to join Wellesley. Still, it had been decades since the British public had received news of an engagement with such appalling casualty numbers. Talavera was the bloodiest battle fought by the British military in at least 50 years. And in a far-off country where the government had been hesitant to commit troops. Still, the British public seems to have deemed the sacrifice worthwhile. News of the victory touched off celebrations all over the country. Wellesley and his men were praised in pamphlets, plays, and verse. The Tory politician John Wilson Croker wrote a poem about the battle, called Talavera, which became a massive success, and seems to have captured the public mood. Quote, I would not check the tender sigh, I would not chide the pious tear that leaves the heart and dims the eye, when honored friend and kinsman dear, even upon victory's proudest bier, loved, lost, lamented lie. But I would say for those that die in honor's high career, for those in glory's grave who sleep, weep fondly, but exulting weep. End quote. Once again, General Sir Arthur Wellesley had lived up to all the expectations placed on him. It is worth reminding ourselves that Wellesley's rise had never been a sure thing. He had won most of his laurels in India, and until quite recently was derided by some as a sepoy general, suited to colonial service, but a class below officers who took part in real warfare against Britain's European rivals. When Wellesley was first sent to Iberia back in 1808, many of his own officers had expressed misgivings about his leadership. The government seemed to agree. They had replaced him with more senior generals almost as soon as he arrived. But now, with his victory at Talavera, the sepoy general had cemented his position as the British Army's paramount commander, at least for the moment. In fact, the government was so pleased with Wellesley's performance, they awarded him not one but two noble titles, a lesser secondary title, the Baron of Douro, in honor of his crossing of the Douro River only a few months earlier, and a more prestigious primary title in honor of his most recent victory, Viscount Wellington of Talavera. And so, for the rest of his life, the man we have been referring to as Wellesley would be known as Wellington. For the rest of this episode, I'd like to turn away from Iberia, across the Mediterranean, to Italy. That might be a bit of an abrupt transition, but there were some close parallels between the situation in the center of the Italian peninsula and the situation in Spain. These were both places where Napoleon had become fed up with diplomacy and geopolitics, and decided to use naked force to bend recalcitrant foreign leaders to his will. In Spain, the unfortunate foreign monarchs had been the dysfunctional Spanish Bourbon dynasty. In Italy, it was the head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Pius VII. Napoleon's relationship with the church was very complicated. At least by this stage of his life, he was a sincere believer, and genuinely wanted peace between France and the Vatican, as well as between his government and conservative French Catholics. However, as was often the case, Napoleon's idea of peace was forcing his adversaries to accept his point of view. The agreement signed by Napoleon and Vatican representatives in 1801, known as the Concordat, had theoretically solved the outstanding issues between Paris and Rome. In practice, the Vatican representatives came out of this experience feeling like they'd been manhandled, especially after Napoleon altered the terms of the agreement after it had been signed. Even after the Concordat, the emperor seems to have actually taken pleasure in snubbing the pope. You might recall Pius had been treated pretty shabbily when he came to Paris to bless Napoleon's coronation ceremony. In fact, the pope had been so annoyed with the French, he had nearly backed out at the last minute. Maybe there was something psychological going on here. Catholicism had been a central feature of Napoleon's childhood. Then he had drifted into anti-clerical Jacobinism in his youth, and now was apparently back in the fold. Although, as we've discussed, Napoleon never totally abandoned his revolutionary roots, and he had always been a skeptic and a free thinker by nature, and made a very idiosyncratic Catholic. There were also practical reasons for the ongoing friction with the Church. Remember, at this stage in history, the Pope was more than a purely spiritual leader. He was a political sovereign with well over a million subjects, ruling over what historians call the Papal State, or the Papal States, a large stretch of territory right in the heart of central Italy. On top of his moral authority, he had a government, bureaucracy, and even a rudimentary military behind him, and engaged in international diplomacy, just like any other sovereign. These facts had never sat well with Napoleon, certainly not when he was a Jacobin, and even now when he was supposedly reconciled to the Church. As we've discussed many times in past episodes, he had an almost instinctive desire to centralize, modernize, and rationalize. The Pope and his domains were an independent source of power right in the heart of Napoleon's empire, literally surrounded by French puppet states, and commanding the loyalty of millions of his subjects. Men of the Enlightenment, like Napoleon, considered the Papal States to be poorly governed, tradition-bound, and backwards in every sense of the word. They actually had a point. The Pope's administration was one of the worst in Europe. Most of the administrative innovations we've discussed over the course of this show had passed the Papal States by. The Pope also maintained friendly relations with France's rivals, in particular the Habsburgs, who had maintained a close, although not always friendly, relationship with the Vatican for centuries. Almost everything about the continued existence of the Papal States went against Napoleon's instincts. In 1801, he had been willing to swallow his objections in the name of peace. But after his coronation, as his relationship with the Pope began to deteriorate again, he was rethinking that approach. Both men felt the other was disrespectful. Some of this was personal, but some was philosophical. Napoleon believed the Papal States should be subordinate to his empire, while the Pope believed his political powers and his spiritual powers were inseparable, and that to diminish one would be to diminish the other. You might remember that Pius's election in 1800 had been seen as a good sign for Franco-Vatican relations. Pius was seen as having a moderate, modern outlook, unlike many of his fellow cardinals, who were more ideologically reactionary and anti-French. Pius and Napoleon had indeed tried to work together, but each man felt he should be the senior partner in this relationship, which makes collaboration impossible. Napoleon wrote to his ambassador to the Vatican, quote, "Tell them that I have my eyes open, that I am only fooled inasmuch as I let myself be fooled, that I am Charlemagne, the sword of the Church, and their emperor, and that I should be treated as such. I have briefly laid out my intentions. If the Pope does not reply, I shall reduce him to the condition of his predecessors before Charlemagne." End quote. Pius countered, referring to himself in the third person, quote, "I reply with apostolic frankness that the Holy Father does not recognize and has never recognized in his states any power superior to his own, and that no emperor has any rights over Rome." End quote. Napoleon's continental system proved to be another source of conflict. He demanded the Papal States participate in the embargo on British trade, but the Pope had no interest in complying, and his weak administration might not have been able to enforce an embargo even if he'd wanted to. And so, in late 1805, French troops occupied the port city of Ancona, within the Papal States, to close it to British shipping. In 1806, they occupied another port city, Civitavecchia. These were the two main commercial ports within the Papal States. The country's international trade was now almost completely under French control. But it wasn't enough. The Pope continued in his independent foreign policy, friendly to France's enemies. Anti-imperial rebels continued to find safe haven in papal territory. And, perhaps worst of all, the Pope remained unwilling to subordinate his temporal political powers to the empire. In early 1808, Napoleon wrote to his brother Joseph, at this point still King of Naples, telling him, quote, "Brother, the impertinences of the court of Rome know no bounds. My patience is at an end." End quote. In February of that year, a French infantry division crossed the northern border of the Papal States and marched south to occupy Rome. Napoleon had expected bloodshed, either some kind of token resistance by the small, weak papal army or a civilian uprising, but there was only eerie calm as the French methodically occupied fortifications and strategic locations within the city and surrounding countryside. The whole Catholic world waited with bated breath. What would become of the Pope's temporal powers? Would Pius remain a sovereign ruler, or become just another religious figure? Would he be replaced, or perhaps worse, taken into captivity in France, like his predecessor? Would Rome remain the center of the Church, or would the leadership be forced to break with over 1,000 years of tradition and set up shop elsewhere? Would Catholicism even continue to exist in its current form? Napoleon's northern Italian satellite state, the Kingdom of Italy, formally annexed some of the territory of the Papal States, and France formally broke off diplomatic relations with the Vatican. However, there was no official word on any of these broader questions. Amazingly, this state of limbo would continue for well over a year. Throughout history, the people of Rome have been renowned for their ability to keep up business as usual, whatever political or geopolitical turmoil happened to touch the city, and that's just what they did. In fact, the Romans went to great lengths to ignore the occupation entirely, refusing to socialize, do business, or even speak with the French occupiers whenever possible. They were taking their lead from the Pope, who had embarked on a campaign of passive resistance. Historians have compared the situation within the city to modern campaigns of civil disobedience. Of course, senior members of the church hierarchy could not help but worry. A leading cardinal would later describe this period of limbo as, quote, awaiting the final crisis. The days and nights which we passed in anxiety were more bitter than death, end quote. The Pope himself pursued a strategy of non-confrontation. He registered official objections to the actions of the French, but always remained courteous. He knew this occupation was a public relations nightmare for France. And so, the more accommodating and magnanimous he seemed, the worse it looked for Bonaparte. Many of his cardinals were urging him to incite a rebellion. The Dos de Mayo uprising in Madrid occurred only a few months after the French occupation began. Like many conservatives and reactionaries, the cardinals were intoxicated by the idea of a counter-revolutionary, anti-French mass rebellion. But Pius waved them off. He was playing the long game. He believed meeting force with force would ultimately only benefit the French. This was a moment of incredible danger for the Church, one of the worst it had faced in centuries. The Pope's actions helped solidify the Church's prestige, both on the international stage and in the hearts of average Catholics. It also generated sympathy for the Church, after a long period in which intellectuals had been questioning its power, doctrines, and even the very concept of organized religion. But most of all, Pius was right about how badly this approach would hurt Bonaparte. If he was here to defend himself, Napoleon would probably say that Pius was a hypocrite. The Pope acted like he was a man of peace, leading an entirely peaceful religion. Meanwhile, he intrigued with France's enemies, his priests and bishops preached war against the empire, and the Church even gave material assistance to blood-soaked terrorists, like the Spanish guerrillas or the Italian Sanfedisti rebels. But to most of the world, this all made Napoleon look like a warmonger and a tyrant, once again resorting to naked force to solve his political problems. And this time, he wasn't bullying some powerful foreign monarch, but a religious institution that had never posed any serious threat to the empire. So perhaps it's not surprising Bonaparte left the Church in limbo for so long. As we've seen over the past dozen or so episodes, he had quite a lot on his plate throughout this period, and some of the explanation here is probably that he was simply distracted. But I think some of it is also the fact that Pius's peaceful resistance had presented him with a no-win situation. Finally, in May of 1809, shortly before the Battle of Aspern-Essling, Napoleon bit the bullet and signed a decree annexing the remains of the Papal States, and formally ending the temporal political power of the Pope, which his predecessors had held for over 1,000 years. Rome was still occupied by imperial troops, and the Pope was now reduced to the status of a private citizen who happened to work as a senior clergyman. But even at this stage, Napoleon was afraid to disregard him entirely. He offered Pius the eye-popping sum of 2 million francs a year in compensation for the loss of his territories. Napoleon had waited for over a year to make this move. Pius had had plenty of time to think about a counterstroke. When this momentous news reached Rome, the Pope immediately told his subordinates to release a pronouncement he had pre-written for just this occasion. Like all papal pronouncements right up until the present day, this document is known by a Latin title, the Cum Memoranda, meaning roughly, on that memorable day. In it, the Pope made the case that the French occupation of Rome, their subsequent treatment of the Church, and the annexation of the Pope's territory was much more than just a violation of the sovereignty of the Papal States under international law. It was a sin against the Catholic religion. In response, the Pope would administer the most severe punishment in Catholic canon law. Quote, "By the authority of Almighty God, and that of the holy apostles Peter and Paul, and our own, we declare that all those who, after the invasion of Rome and the ecclesiastical territory, and the sacrilegious violation of St. Peter's patrimony by French troops, have committed, either at Rome or in the States of the Church, against ecclesiastical immunities and against the simple temporal rights of the Church and Holy See, either all or any of the outrages which have provoked our complaints, all authors, promoters, counselors, or adherents of similar doings, all those, finally, who have contributed to facilitate the realization of these violent acts, or have accomplished them, we declare that all such have incurred the canonical excommunication, censure, and punishment." End quote. To put it in plain English, any Catholic who had played a role in the French invasion of Rome was excommunicated. Although he was not named, there could be no doubt that this applied to Napoleon himself, as well as to many in the French government and military. It is worth dwelling briefly on what excommunication actually means. An excommunicated person does not cease to be a Catholic. In fact, it is hoped that the excommunicated person changes their behavior and performs penance, in which case the excommunication is lifted and the person goes back to being a normal part of the Catholic laity. However, until that happens, they are prohibited from taking part in the sacraments of the Church. For a person who sincerely believes in Catholic teachings, this is almost tantamount to being condemned to hell. As we've discussed, it is considered the most serious punishment in church law, more serious even than execution. Napoleon was a cold, cynical realist who never gave much thought to spiritual matters. But by all accounts, he really was a believer, and the church had been a part of his life as long as he could remember, even if it was sometimes as an adversary. Even for a man like Napoleon, I would imagine the experience of excommunication was quite uncomfortable. What happened next is a subject of some controversy. These are the facts. Late in the night of July 5, 1809, a large party of French soldiers led by General Étienne Radet entered the papal residence. It was a complete farce. The papal residence is a huge complex, and difficult to navigate for outsiders, especially in the dark. None of the soldiers knew how to get to the Pope's chambers, or even if he was still there. Some of the soldiers took detours to loot, some simply got lost. With strange armed men roaming the complex, one of Pius's servants began ringing an alarm bell. And soon there were confused servants, cooks, and priests running through the halls in their bedclothes. Finally, most of the party found their way to the Pope's bedroom and arrested him at around 2 a.m. The man in charge of this fiasco, General Radet, had a reputation as a bit of a barbarian, which is probably why he was selected for this mission. He was deemed unlikely to have an attack of conscience that might prevent him from doing his duty. Much later, someone asked Radet how it felt to arrest the Pope. He said it was like any other mission, until he actually came face to face with the Holy Father. Quote, "At that moment, my first communion flashed before my eyes." End quote. But it was only a moment. Radet followed his orders, and the Pope became a prisoner of the French army. At the time, almost everyone assumed this was an official act. You would think such a drastic step would not have been taken without direct orders from the emperor, but some sources claim Napoleon was actually surprised by these events. I have my doubts. Napoleon was generally livid when his subordinates took such drastic measures without orders. Radet was not punished. In fact, later that same year, he was granted a noble title, which I don't think would have happened if he had just kidnapped the Pope without orders. Pius was quickly spirited out of the city, to forestall any attempts by the church hierarchy or the people of Rome to free him. But it seems the French couldn't decide what to do with him next. He was brought to various cities in Italy, then over the border to southern France, then back to Italy, then back to France again, finally ending up at the famous Fontainebleau Palace outside Paris. The Pope may have been stripped of his sovereign political powers, but thanks to his campaign of passive resistance over the preceding 18 months, culminating in his unjustified and illegal arrest at the hands of French soldiers, his moral stature had never been higher. Many Catholics all over the world came to view Pius as something like a living martyr, a man who had surrendered his freedom and put his life in danger to protect the faith, when it would have been very easy for him to bend the knee and save himself. To their credit, the French did not lock Pius away in some dungeon. The Pope was given comfortable, even luxurious, accommodations. I would guess that, as a prisoner, he was living much better than almost everyone who was celebrating him as a great martyr. Pius was allowed to carry on his business as leader of the Roman Catholic Church without much interference from his captors. The French authorities, including Napoleon, continued to refer to him as Your Holiness, with all the deference due to a pope. And Pius continued to refer to Napoleon as My Son, as he did with all Catholic monarchs. It was a strange captivity, but Pius never forgot that he was a prisoner. He continued with much the same approach he had in Rome, protesting his treatment at every step, but always careful to remain polite and cooperative, and always expressing hope for reconciliation. Now that he was in Napoleon's power, the emperor periodically leaned on Pius, trying to get him to sign some kind of compromise that would acknowledge the annexation of the papal states and the end of his status as a sovereign monarch. But Pius refused to budge, polite but firm as always. Napoleon couldn't really lean on him any harder without adding to the Pope's reputation as a martyr and making himself look even worse. And so there was a strange stalemate between the world's most famous prisoner and his jailer. Pius would remain in French custody for the next 5 years. If you'll think back to our episodes on the period just after Napoleon's seizure of power, you might recall that his regime was greeted with optimism. In fact, he was seen by many as a man of peace, who would finally end the cycle of war and political turmoil that had plagued Europe since the outbreak of the Revolution. I think by now it's safe to say all those hopes had been dashed. By late 1809, the idea of Napoleon as some kind of peacemaker was starting to seem downright ridiculous. Bonaparte's actions in Iberia and Italy had shown that he had completely lost patience with the normal course of politics and diplomacy, and was now committed to forcing his vision on the continent. To the rest of the world, he was looking more and more like a warmonger, not as a potential solution to Europe's geopolitical instability, but one of its primary sources. Perhaps that was not entirely fair. The recent war with Austria was certainly not Napoleon's doing. In fact, he had tried to prevent it, although he'd done so by rattling his saber at Vienna, hoping to secure peace through deterrence, which hadn't exactly calmed things down. By this stage of his career, force seemed to be the only tool in Napoleon's diplomatic repertoire, either its threat or its direct application. He still believed the war could be brought to a successful conclusion in the near future, but the more he tightened his grip on Europe, the more it seemed to slip through his grasp. That's all for now. For those of you who are signed up on Patreon, I'll be back to you in a few weeks with another bonus episode. If you have a question, log into Patreon and leave it in the comments section of the previous bonus episode. As for the rest of you, I'll be back to you in 1 month with more from the main narrative. And as always, thanks for listening.